Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Thunder Buddies podcast. I'm Eric Horn. I'm here with my colleague, Maddie Lee, in the Oklahoman studios in Oklahoma City. And we have a special guest on the podcast today. I've already butchered his last name once, which required us to restart the podcast. But now that, you know, I have this whole reading comprehension thing, I opened up his Twitter bio. We are proud to have Andrew Greif of the Los Angeles Times. He covers the Clippers for the Los Angeles Times. Andrew, thanks for your patience, and thanks for joining us today.
No, I'm very glad to be on with you guys.
That was much smoother than the initial intro where I said your last name was Greif, even though I invited you on the podcast. That's like a podcast faux pas. You can't invite someone on the podcast and not know how to pronounce their last name.
I also, though, appreciate your honesty, because you could have gone on and just skirted by it, not told anyone that we messed up the first time, but you're a newspaper man.
We're candid
with principles.
Here. No, we're candid here. I appreciate Andrew for not immediately hanging up and vowing to never speak to us again.
That would have been fun.
It was a consideration.
you frankly should have, because we should be put in our place more often. But look, you could also credit us in a sense, not us, Maddie and I, but like our city and this entity that we are covering, for providing you with quite a fruitful summer, I must say. I mean,
so fruitful. The biggest, of course, today's news that Patrick Patterson has been waived and will join the Clippers after clearing waivers.
Yes, that's the big news of the summer.
To Woj's reporting,
and
obviously that one's better than that.
Andrew,
I think his name is something like Paul George.
That fella. I forgot about him. Yeah, he's a big deal.
Yeah, there seems to be a move from OKC. Are you guys planning on moving out here as well? can we break any news that way?
That's the next
great
wave.
that'll be on the Players Tribune. I'll do my Kevin Durant-esque thing where I follow Paul to the Bay. Shout out to Anthony Slater of The Athletic for that move to the Bay Area News Group. No, Andrew, just what was it like for you when this went down? Because I'll tell you where I was. I was asleep. And then I woke up to a flurry of text messages and calls, and Maddie was already on the case. But what was this situation like for you when Paul got traded? And I presume you were in Vegas.
Yeah, first of all, I feel like this is kind of like our generation, at least NBA fans' version of like, where were you when JFK got shot? Like everyone has a story, and it's actually been a pretty fun like icebreaker all summer. Be like, hey, where were you? And like coaches and like, you know, colleagues, like everyone remembers. So I was in my Las Vegas Summer League hotel room, and I was preparing to maybe meet up with some people to kind of chat. And then I was on my computer. I literally happened to be in the exact perfect place. But you know, phone on, charge, computer on my lap. I was doing
you may have
homework.
Been the only one.
So it was like within a couple seconds I was trying to send texts and get in touch with people who might know the particulars. So I would say I count myself lucky that plans fell through earlier in the evening to meet up with people earlier.
Yeah, that's kind of like the position I was in, except like I wasn't awake. Like I started working probably an hour after everybody else did, or maybe even 2 hours. And then as I woke up, I didn't even panic. I was just like, okay, Paul George, cool. And then I just started texting people and calling people. I was just like, what the hell is going on? But I can't imagine what it was like for you to not only be on the Kawhi beat, basically, for, you know, not just this period of free agency, but for the entire year with all the rumblings going on in Los Angeles, but in one fell swoop to have Kawhi and Paul George be a part of this free agency for the Clippers. Like, can you kind of give people who listen to the Thunder like perspective on how significant it is for the Clippers to be able to pull off the coup that they did? Because you wrote about it, but it's like, I think that people who follow the Thunder for the past 10 or 11 years have like always had these stars and this star power. And the Clippers have had star power, but never the kind of success, I think, that they had in this offseason in terms of like getting these guys to come here or go to Los Angeles, rather.
Yeah, they've had stars, but the distinction with this is that with Kawhi Leonard, I should say, is that the stars they acquired previously, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, they drafted, Chris Paul, they traded for. Now, Blake and CP3 re-signed as free agents at various points, but they had never really lured away a top free agent from another team in free agency. That has just never happened since they moved to LA in 1984. Bill Walton was like the biggest free agent they'd ever signed, and that was when they were still in San Diego. So I think that even though the Clippers gonna benefit or would seem to have benefited from being in a glamorous market that a lot of people probably want to play for, they had never themselves been a glamorous destination. And so the fact that they were able to get a Kawhi Leonard, essentially make him say, I choose you over a team that I just want a championship with, and the team in the LA market that has always been the one that has received the stars, that is what had people in the NBA and especially the Clippers really celebrating, because it was like a stamp of approval that the way they've kind of gone about their business recently with Steve Ballmer and Doc and Lawrence Frank, that it essentially has worked. That people, they say, okay, I see what you're doing and I like what you're doing, and I will voluntarily come there. And that is something that they've never really had happen before with top free agents. They had a meeting with LeBron in 2010, but it was kind of like a courtesy meeting. No one really thought he was ever going to show up. And so the fact that a guy who was not only probably the top free agent in the market, but also a Southern California guy who knows the pull of the Lakers, and essentially have Paul George, another guy who grew up in Southern California who also knew the pull of the Lakers, say, I want to go here being the Clippers, that was the big difference for the Clippers this offseason.
Are you laughing at all at the Lakers writers, some of whom who came over for LeBron, and you've been there, and suddenly two stars land in your lap?
It's, well, what I'm going to be really fascinated by is just the difference in media coverage this year. This is maybe a little inside baseball, but I mean, I came from the Clippers beat from covering college sports, and like there were some times when I would have to do a story on like a fairly like low level college team, just like the offhand feature, you know, mm-hmm. in Oregon. And there would be more media sometimes at those availabilities than there were covering the Clippers. Whereas the Lakers, it was always an army because of the interest. So I'll be curious whether that changes this coming season. I think obviously it will a little bit, but it's going to be just a whole new fascinating dynamic.
Got to sharpen your elbows before season starts. Get through those scrums.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting for you. I mean, just from just a battling other people standpoint, it's going to be interesting to see how that's all split up in terms of the media coverage. Andrew, you know, Kevin Durant coming out of Oklahoma City, going to Golden State, was a big shock to a lot of people around here. And I know that Durant, you know, everybody was kind of owned in on Durant in this free agency period. And the Clippers were one of those teams that was kind of thrown out there. Like, do you have any knowledge of like how close Durant was to picking the Clippers, or if that could have been an actual possibility with him?
I think that I remember even a couple days before free agency began, hearing that they really did feel like they were an option. Like, it wasn't just lip service. They really did feel like he would take a look at them. But I also feel like during the year, I never got a great sense from the Clippers themselves that they really felt like he was dead set on them. It seemed like what they were doing had intrigued him. I knew they felt that way. that they were doing something right. Like, they were not out of the picture, but I never really felt like they were truly in it. But even late before free agency, it seemed like, okay, like, we're going to get a meeting. And then seemed like no one got a meeting, and he just went to Brooklyn. But I do think they were among those probably, what, two or three teams that he was that he had eyes on and really thought hard about, would I fit there? So there was some interest. Obviously, it was never going to be consummated in a free agency signing, but he was really interested in them when he left for Golden State, too. He took a meeting. Ballmer was there. Lawrence Frank was there. I believe Doc Rivers was there at the Hamptons. And that was a time when the Clippers couldn't even really literally sign him. Like, they didn't have the space, but he was interested enough in what they were doing, what Ballmer was about, that he took the meeting. I know that people felt like, even after that 2016 meeting, they felt like they'd left a really good impression. So I think that's what played into this year's kind of why he would even consider them.
I think that's important for franchises to do that. Like, and especially franchises that have had kind of the checkered past that the Clippers have had, and they've had a lot of success in the last decade, but, like, just to be able to get in the room with guys like that. I remember there's a story about Pat Riley and LaMarcus Aldridge, and Pat Riley talked about how, you know, they didn't have necessarily the space to sign LaMarcus Aldridge, but, you know, they wanted to get in the room with him and say, like, you know, this is basically send the message, like, next year this could be, like, a possibility. So we want to be in the room with those guys, and, like, I think that's really valuable, particularly like in the day of player movement now, when you just to get the opportunity to get in front of guys that control their own destiny, like, that doesn't go away. People don't forget those meetings, and they don't forget those interactions that you have with front offices and coaches. So maybe that was something that kind of, you know, played a role in these guys getting prepared to go after, you know, a guy like Kawhi and be able to consummate this thing.
In so many ways, NBA is a wildly different job than other jobs, but that's one thing that's similar, right? Like, anyone who's trying to move up in a field has to keep those connections and keep talking to people, even if they don't necessarily have an opening.
Well, and players talk, you know. I'm sure that there's a scenario where a player who met with the Clippers before said, you know, hey, I didn't go there, but, and essentially told other players about what interested in them. So I think that's another payoff, just having words circulate that, wow, Ballmer is, you know, really all in on this. And did you know he's worth $50 billion? And I think look at Portland. I mean, they signed guys. They got Kent Bazemore and Pau Gasol this offseason. And those guys were guys they whiffed on, I believe, in 2016. Mm-hmm. But essentially the story I was reading was that they said that they made a strong impression on them. And when it came open again, they said, I remembered that. So I think there's a lot of value from teams, just like you said, Eric, just getting in the room.
Andrew, you know, the Clippers go and they get Michael Winger a few years ago, and that's a guy who, you know, made his bones in the Thunder organization. It was an important part of the Thunder organization. What role did he play in kind of getting this Kawhi deal done and getting Kawhi to come to LA? Because Winger's a guy who's highly respected in the league, and people, you know, have kind of lauded him for, you know, some of the work he's done in the past couple of years to kind of get the Clippers in this position.
Yeah, he's not a guy who was in the room for the presentation when they met July 1st at Doc Rivers' house. You know, he wasn't a guy in the room, but he's behind the scenes. He's, you know, making sure that they're obviously on track, carrying out a lot of the vision that the Ballmer puts out, Lawrence Frank puts out. Like, he's tasked with making sure it all works. And so I also thought that he was interesting that he was the guy who helped initiate talks for Paul George a couple years ago. And so he's really been on both ends of Paul George arriving in OKC and then leaving. He's been, you know, he's a salary cap kind of wizard, as people would have referred to him before to me. He's just very, very smart, very considered. I think that more than anything, I think, again, as people, I think players are more knowledgeable, not only about the teams they play for and the teammates they'll play with, but the executives that will be part of it. And it seems like a Winger is one of the guys, along with some of their assistant GMs and Lawrence Frank, who has a really strong reputation on the league. And so I think that kind of word also seems to spread about they're putting together a pretty strong, a very deep front office. Like, you're going to be in good hands. And he's right up there. I mean, I've talked to a lot of executives who basically are like, that guy knows his stuff.
Andrew, did they give you all any time in a scrum to talk to Kawhi and Paul at that introductory press conference, or was it just the stuff on the stage?
There was stuff on the stage, and then they were hustled into an interview with, I believe, Rachel Nichols, and then they each did an interview with Chris Haynes, and then a local media, there were no one-on-one time or scrum time. So we'll, I guess we'll introduce ourselves later down the road. But there was, it was mostly the stage.
What did you take from that presser? What was the lasting impression for you?
You know, I was kind of interested. I knew there wasn't going to be a whole lot newsy out of it, but I wanted to know, what I asked them was just, you know, when are you guys going to play together? Because that's the big attraction, right? And so Paul George said that he didn't have a timetable for his return from the shoulder surgeries, plural. Right. You know, I don't think there's any indication he'll be ready for the season opener. That's what I've received. But I was interested that Kawhi said that the load management, as it was carried out in Toronto, maybe sort of like a one-off, or at least it's not necessarily his approach that he'll go into the season with. He said he wants to play the whole season. Obviously, he's going to make sure he's ready for the playoffs. So I wouldn't expect him to play 82 games, but I was expecting him fully to say, yeah, that worked. Let's run it back. Let's do it just like we did in Toronto. But it seems like he wants to play a lot.
Yeah, and that's a big question, too, going into the season. I think that, you know, as soon as the deal got done, everybody immediately vaulted the Clippers up to the top of the league. And look, that's pending health, because you just don't know what Paul George is going to be when he comes back, and when he's going to come back. And I think that was a big question with the Thunder, too, and probably played a big factor into, you know, how much upside this team has going forward, because they basically just ran their heads into a wall the past, you know, two or three seasons with Russell Westbrook and Paul George. I think I had a question there, but I completely forgot. But
well, for me, that's why Patrick Patterson makes sense. I don't know about you guys, but like, or Mo Harkless too, the moves for him, Jermichael Green, like, if you don't have a, you know, crystal clear idea of exactly what their availability are going to be like with George and Leonard, then I think it helps to have somewhat of a glut at forward. Like, I know the glut at forward kind of hurt Patrick Patterson, OKC, at least the minutes he received. But here it's like, you know, I think those guys could be in line for a little more run, given the availability of the health of their two main stars.
Yeah, and Pat's a guy who, as we very clearly saw last season, as he started the season, expected to be a starter, was demoted to a second unit guy, and then dropped completely out of the rotation. And he's not going to throw up a fuss about that, even if he doesn't get the playing time that he wants.
That's an interesting note, because the Clippers have been pretty adamant that whoever they add, they want to basically fit within this ideal of a Clippers player. And that is essentially like pretty much a no fuss guy. Like, they don't want drama. They want players who just are there to play basketball and go about it in kind of a lunch pail attitude. And so hearing that makes me feel like there's some compatibility between his approach and what the Clippers have been trying to add.
Yeah, I think Pat will be fine in whatever role he's in, and he'll probably just be infinitely more happy because he's in Los Angeles and he gets to be around.
And his new movies. Wife will get to stay around. She's really good friends with Paul George's significant other, so I'm not saying that that's why he wants to go to LA.
What if we find out a condition of the trade was Paul George needed Patrick Patterson to get waived so that they could complete the entire thing, and it's all really about the swimsuit about, conglomerate they're putting together
about Daniela and Sarah.
Yeah, what if it's just all about that? What if it's not really even a Kawhi thing? It's all about just like getting a swimsuit empire
going. That would be amazing. For anyone who didn't read my story on this, Daniela Rogic and Sarah Nasser started a swimsuit company together while they were here in Oklahoma City. It's called Nude Swim. They launched right before the summer, and they're still putting out new stuff. So
I feel like we're putting push pins on a corkboard and putting like the yarn around them, connecting them. Like,
yes,
it's really feeling like everything is coming together right now about how this all went down.
Yeah, and the next part I really want to get into is kind of like the Thunder side of things, and this is also, I mean, it's also the Clippers side too, but
the former Clippers,
the picks, some of the risk that comes on the Clippers side as well, because look, on the immediate face of it, you obviously have the two best players going to the Clippers. But you got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander going to the Thunder, who the Clippers did not want to part with. You've got Danilo Gallinari going to the Thunder, who's coming off the best season of his career. And then you've got the greatest picks haul in NBA history. Andrew, from your perspective and from speaking to people around the Clippers, obviously this was worth it for them to do it, to get these two guys. But the ramifications of the deal, you know, giving up a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, giving up essentially the future, in terms of the picks, and then Kawhi's contract situation with him being on, you know, having the option to basically opt out in the final year of that deal and go into free agency in 2 years. Like, how do you assess all of that, talking to all the people that you've been around on that beat?
So I think that where I had to start with all this is that Steve Ballmer badly wants to win. Like, he wants to win an NBA championship. He's never been shy about that. Even back to his Microsoft days, like, he wants to win in everything. And this all goes back to opening up a window, even if it's brief, to win an NBA title or two. I think that's where all the risk for him, and he, you know, he's ultimately the person who has to sign off on this stuff. That's where it makes sense, because now they have this chance to open up a title window. If it goes longer than 2 years, if both guys re-sign in 2021, if they opt out, then they can come back and make it even longer. But if they can win something, that can project some momentum. And then the Clippers, you know, they want to open up a new arena in 2024. I think that would help, obviously, getting some energy behind that. So I just think that the title is the thing for him. And although they didn't want to part with, I think, probably all that stuff, if they had to pick, I'm sure they wouldn't have wanted to give away all that. The fact is, they have this chance now to do something that the Clippers have never done, and that is ultimately what Ballmer wants, what the Clippers want. So it's almost like, if it happens, it's going to be worth it. They want to be in the mix. And that scrappy team last year, the eighth seed, that, you know, made Golden State look silly a couple times in the playoffs before ultimately losing. That was a really fun year. Like, everyone left the building being like, that was a hell of a year. Doc Rivers called it maybe his favorite year of coaching. But it's still, you're not winning. And Doc Rivers wants to win again. I'm sure Kawhi wants to win again. The Clippers want to win for the first time. So that's why I think if you're looking at the pros and cons in the short term, it just gives them the opportunity to be in that mix, especially with Golden State no longer that dominant force.
In terms of the Thunder's future, I think, obviously, Gallinari's, we've seen him, he's good. But I'm more interested in SGA. What are you expecting from him in his second year?
He is someone who is beloved by the Clippers. They saw him and Landry Shamet as like the backcourt of the future. So that was a really hard thing to part with. People were like downright despondent when he was traded because they just felt like his future is so big. I think for year two, you know, he was a guy who he had some ups and downs as a rookie, I think all do, but ultimately they stuck by him almost the entire year. He started off, I believe, in his 10th game, he became a starter. And from that point forward, they basically said, look, kid, like, we're not going to baby you. This is your show. And so I would expect to see him maybe get a little more aggressive looking for his own shot. He's a really good playmaker, but I think I'd like to see him be a little more accurate from the three-point line, diversify his game that way. But he's just got a lot of moves that I know that Sam Cassell worked them a lot. He was his kind of primary coach as an assistant here, but there were a lot of things that – it wasn't like Sam taught him that or Doc taught him that. He's just got stuff in his bag that is unique, and that's why they felt like kind of that preternatural talent, stuff you can't always teach, he had that. So I'll be really curious to see how – he develops. Like I said, there's a couple areas of his game. I'm sure he shoot three better, but he's got a really good vision.
I'm kind of in the process right now going through that first round series against Golden State and just watching him specifically. And some of the things that have jumped out to me is just like you were talking about them starting him from the 10th game in the season, just the amount of trust they had in a guy like that as a rookie. You know, they start against Golden State in that first game, and he's having to guard Steph. They put him on Steph Curry to start the game. He's face guarding Steph Curry essentially on like every possession of the first quarter. And it's like, to me, that just says so much about how much they trusted him, and he did a good job. Like, he's not out here getting crushed. So, I mean, the defensive upside is really exciting for me, and a guy that's as long as he is and can play as many positions across the backcourt, even into, you know, a small forward kind of range, and guard multiple positions. Like, for them to throw him out against a Steph Curry in that series, like, I thought that was really interesting and really showed a lot of trust in that dude.
Yeah, they trust is the ultimate word. They definitely trusted him. You know, they felt like you're only going to get better by playing a lot, being put in a lot of positions, and they never held him back. You know, they didn't feel like that was worth it for his development, for the team's own development. And I would say the Clippers were better in April because Shea was better over the course of the year. You know, you saw the learning happen. I would say December to early January, he kind of seemed like there was a little bit of that quote unquote rookie wall. He was pretty candid about talking about the differences he felt between, you know, the college game, what he was experiencing in the pros, having to be on pretty much every night. But I really do feel like the way he played and Landry Shamet played together, especially in the playoff series, that's what got a lot of people excited. Even after that first round exit, they were just like, wow, if that's like a small window into our backcourt's future, then we feel pretty good about it. Remember, he hit Landry Shamet for that the game-winning three when they came back from 31 down. It was Shea's assist. He drives it into the free throw line, looks to his right, sees Landry spotting up, and he hit him there. And people pointed at that pass. You know, he could have taken a shot there himself, but he found Landry, and that's something people pointed to a lot.
Yeah, I've liked so far what I've seen from him. For some reason or another, I just can't remember him in the regular season against the Thunder. I don't know why I don't remember. I think I was just more caught up with the fact that Gallinari and Tobias Harris were destroying them. And but
absolutely, no, they destroyed
them. But I think that also kind of speaks to a little bit of what we saw from SGA in his first year. You know, what I noticed in just watching a little bit of the first round series is he gets off the ball pretty early in possessions. Like, he's not a guy who's pounding the ball, dominating possessions with his dribble. And that's something that's a pretty stark difference from a Russell Westbrook or a Dennis Schroeder that we've seen over the past few seasons in Oklahoma City, where these guys, you know, Billy Donovan puts the ball in these guys' hands and he's saying, okay, you guys go create on your own. But Shea is, you know, he'll hand off, get to the corner, dribble handoffs, different movement, a lot more movement from him, I think we can expect coming into this season with the Thunder, and a guy who's going to be a little bit more off ball and, you know, can spot up from the corners as well.
Yeah, that playmaking kind of guard role that he, like you said, that you alluded to, that's something that the Clippers is somewhat missing on their roster right now. I'll be curious if they fill that. They have lots of ball handlers, lots of guys who are capable, but not that one guy that Shea, the skills that he kind of had that you're describing, I think that's something obviously they're missing. I remember one thing about the Thunder series is that he seemed to get a couple times, I want to say this was in Oklahoma City, I remember Russell backing him down the post, kind of taking advantage that he just wasn't all that strong yet. So I think obviously the strength is something that would have to get better for Shea as well.
When we're talking about his development, obviously the Thunder's roster is in constant flux right now, but as of now, they still have Chris Paul. What do you think about potentially starting them together?
You know, the ball wasn't always in Shea's hands. Patrick Beverley, I want to say kind of that December stretch when Shea was hitting a little bit of a wall, I want to say that Pat seemed to take over some ball handling responsibility, bringing the ball up the court, kind of initiating the offense. So I see Shea as someone who can work as a off-ball guard, happy to share the load. He doesn't have to be the initiator. I think he can run around screens just fine and get himself open. So I don't think it's like a bad fit by any means. Again, I think that, you know, is he going to be a spot up guy, a dead eye 3-point shooter? I think that can be worked on. So if CP3 draws a lot of attention, can you kick it out to him? I think he'll make that shot. So I think he can be a guy who plays alongside a pretty typically ball dominant point guard.
You know, we still have questions here about whether or not Gallinari is going to even last the entire season. You know, just based on what direction the Thunder's going in. You know, he's obviously going to have some value as a trade piece for teams that are looking for shooting at that position. He's coming off, like we said, like essentially the best year of his career in terms of his splits. This guy shot 44.4% from three last year. I mean, oh, actually, that's not true. That was in 08-09. I'm looking at the wrong one. 43.3 last year, which is phenomenal too. But, Andrew, do you think that Gallinari has this – can this be repeatable for him in Oklahoma City? And you might not be able to speak to that fully because you haven't watched the Thunder play and how Billy Donovan likes to put guys in certain places. But, you know, from my recollection, just from Gallinari playing the Thunder, he hit a ton of stuff off the dribble. And I think that that's like the biggest variable from year to year is your off the dribble numbers, because some guys can come out and just bang off the dribble. I think Chris Paul a couple of years ago in that first year with Houston, he was awesome. He was like 38% off the dribble on threes, which is just absurd. But like, do you think that that's repeatable with Gallo now that he had a season where he stayed healthy for a while? You know, he's turning. I think he is 30. He's going to be 31. Like, do you feel like that's a guy who can repeat that coming to a new city and a new system?
That's such a big question, because his health is obviously the thing that people have always wondered about his career. You know, from the very first, he was never really hurt growing up. He said that really it wasn't until he was starting to get into the training camp with the Knicks that he felt like he was lifting like this heavy weights and now this pressure to kind of do some different lifting. That's when he hurt his back, and from there it was kind of, it's been one injury after another at times. But I know that last year off the dribble was something I didn't really expect. I feel like I remembered him like years ago just being obviously a very dependable shooter that you could kick the ball out to and he'd get a shot up. But his ability to get by guys doesn't have like this incredible burst, yet still finds the angle and can, you know, put the ball down with his right hand, kind of stop, and because he's 6'10", gets that shot up just fine. So I think that if he can obviously stay healthy, and he is in training camp right now with the Italian national team, that's something he didn't do last year, kind of wanted to take some wear and tear off his body. He is doing it this year, so he's going to have come into the season with a little bit more mileage on him. But I think that from what I saw, I think that he can probably be close to that kind of guy, because he wasn't doing things that were, it didn't seem like he was, the way he scored were things that were crazy. You know, he wasn't like, he just felt like he had a very sustainable game, you know, taking the shots that were there, not forcing a whole lot. I thought it worked well. You know, and he's going to have a ton of incentive to play well, because even if he does last the year all the way, you know, he's going to be a free agent in a class that's considered pretty weak in 2020. So there's an opportunity where he can really make some money next year, and I don't think that is escaping him.
Yeah, it's a guy who shot, you know, 44.4% on catch and shoots, which is phenomenal, and then 36.4% on pull ups. And while
he averaged something like 28 points per game against the Thunder,
he's incredible. And it's like the Thunder can barely get a guy. I mean, I don't think Dennis Schroeder hit 36% of his catch and shoots last year, and that's what Gallinari is hitting off a pull up. So it's kind of like, and frankly, the Thunder just didn't have a guy at the power forward position who could hit much of anything from the 3-point range. I mean, Patrick Patterson didn't play that much. Jeremy Grant's really a catch and shoot guy. He's not a guy that can create off the dribble. In terms of the jump shot, his mid range game is still kind of meh. All of his damage from three came on catch and shoots. Gallinari, I mean, 36.4% on pull ups. You know, even the ability to do that at 6'10" is pretty impressive. So that's one of the reasons why people are kind of like, the Thunder can kind of push for a playoff spot. If they keep Gallinari and Chris Paul, they're going to be in that mix. I don't think they're going to make the playoffs, but there's an opportunity for them there.
You know, going back to Gallo real quick, last year the majority of his shots came off of catch and shoot. You know, zero dribbles were about 47% of his shots, all of his field goals. But, you know, one dribble, he made 47% of those shots. Two dribbles, 50% of his shots. 3-6 dribbles, 43% of his shots. So, you know, he can put the ball on the ground and shoot it just fine. That's all NBA.com stats.
All right, Andrew, I think we've held you on here long enough. Thank you so much for joining us.
thank you guys for having me. Of course, I'm happy to join, and I'm actually really. I think that initially, I remember thinking like, oh, once the Paul George thing happened, like, oh, kind of write OKC off as that team you have to watch on like your off night. But I'm like legitimately really curious to see what they do. Not only because I know Shea and Danilo, but like, just if they keep that core together, if they keep CP3, if they keep Danilo, like those two guys are super motivated and like. I don't know. I'm just really fascinated to see what their potential really is.
You just made so many Thunder fans happy.
I don't know. Like, who knows what will happen? Maybe they get shipped off by, December. But it just seems like a recipe where two guys really have something to prove. And I guess we'll be curious to see if that really happens.
Reposition, replenish. Andrew found that funny. I find it funny too. I mean,
and then rebuilding will come organically.
And the rebuilding, since Patrick Patterson's gone now, is that a reposition? Okay.
They went straight into rebuild.
All right, Andrew. Thanks for joining us. Thanks everybody for joining us on the Thunder Buddies podcast. We'll be back next week to talk a little bit about. Probably going to get into some Houston Rockets, Russell Westbrook, James Harden talk with a special guest to be decided. And then we will also be podcasting about the schedule whenever that drops. So we'll podcast a week for the next couple weeks. But thanks for listening, subscribing, downloading, and sharing on Apple Podcasts. And we will see you next week. Thanks.